Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscoen. Ever since the 1950s, the world has been producing massive amounts of plastic, 10 billion tons so far, and hundreds of millions of tons being produced every year. It's in our clothing, our packaging, our cosmetics, even in the lining of our soup cans. But there are chemicals in certain plastics that have researchers concerned. In fact, some studies suggest there's a relationship between chemicals like phthalates and BPA to a number of health problems, from infertility to asthma. So this hour, a look at our reliance on plastic and what the research tells us so far about potential health risks, plus what's being done to reduce our dependence on plastic and simple steps we can all take to help ourselves and the planet. Our guests are Dr. Phoebe Stapleton, Assistant Professor of Pharmacology and Toxicology at the Ernest Mario School of Pharmacy and Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences Institute at Rutgers University, where she studies the effect of nanoplastics on maternal fetal health. And also joining us is Judith Enck, Senior Fellow and visiting faculty member at Bennington College. She is the president of Beyond Plastics and former EPA regional administrator. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Tracy.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for tackling this.
Well, this is a big and important subject, and I would like to start with this whole idea of the amount of plastics that we are producing. We just mentioned that the world has generated 10 billion tons of plastic since the 1950s. We're making more all the time. Judith Enck, I'll begin with you. Where does all of that plastic ultimately end up, and how much of it eventually gets recycled?
Well, unfortunately, very little gets recycled, under 10%. So don't listen to those ads from the plastics industry telling you just to toss all your plastics into your recycling bin, because in fact, typically only number one and number two plastic gets recycled. You can see the little numbers on the bottom of the containers. Most plastics are either buried in landfills, burned in garbage incinerators, or wind up as litter, which after rain gets into rivers and then the ocean. And I think what's important to remember is plastic does not degrade. So the plastic that you mentioned from the 1950s, unless it was burned at a garbage incinerator, which introduces a whole host of environmental problems, that plastic is still with us today. And in 2020, 367 million metric tons of plastics were made worldwide. And the forecast is that it will triple by 2050.
So it's not going anywhere. I mean, we continue to manufacture the plastic, and of course, it's all around us. We're highly reliant on it, and we're going to continue to make it, even though we're aware of the potential health risks. Phoebe Stapleton, let me ask you, what are some of the items that we're using that we might not even suspect contain plastics that could be harmful?
They are. They're everywhere, and they're in a variety of different terminologies, I should say. So we know of quite a few. We know of polystyrene, we know of styrofoam, those kinds of commonalities, but we don't know about epoxies and polymers and resins and these other terms that are also used. And so those are often the tricky ones that are kind of used in the lining of cans or used on the surface of tabletops, for example. Nylon, polyester, we've seen that in our clothing for many years and in a lot of our sporting goods equipment, for example, because of the durability, as Judith is mentioning, that they are lasting for thousands of years. Yeah. And I think she makes a great point that the things that were produced in the 1950s are still here. They talk about a reusable bottle or a plastic bottle, like a soda can, for example. Those they guesstimate will be here for about 1,000 years, but in all actuality, nobody's ever been here to see them actually degrade.
Yeah, nobody really knows. And they're in our cosmetics as well, and not just in the packaging of the cosmetics.
Correct. They're used as a variety of fillers as well, and so coatings to make things go on more smoothly, for example, in our personal care products, in makeup, and they just came out of toothpaste and some exfoliating products. We used microbeads for quite a while, I should say, in the early 2000s as an exfoliant, and they've been recently recently, within the last 20 years, taken out of those types of products because we started finding them in the environment.
Yeah. Judith Enck, there is particular concern around single-use plastics. Can you give us some examples of those and why they are of concern?
Sure. So single-use plastic is typically cheap plastic that you use for a short period of time, and a lot of it gets littered. If you live in the city of Philadelphia and you pick up litter in front of your house, you're going to see the same fast food packaging, plastic bags, plastic straws, polystyrene food packaging appear day after day, week after week. Companies use it because it's cheap. And what happens, Tracy, is after it rains, that litter, and I would add also cigarette butts is the most common form of litter, and the filters have plastic in it. So when it rains, a lot of that plastic goes into storm drains, gets into rivers, and then into the ocean. And say it's a plastic water bottle. It's bopping around in the waves. It's exposed to sunlight. The sunlight makes it brittle. The wave action serves almost like a paper shredder. And so one plastic water bottle can become hundreds and thousands of smaller pieces of plastic that is then ingested by fish, by seabirds, by marine life. There's a fiction that a lot of that is on the surface. People have seen pictures of the plastic islands known as gyres. But most of the plastic falls to the bottom, to the sea floor, where it is bioavailable literally for centuries.
Wow. And Judith, what about just drinking the water in the bottles? I was reading that there are microplastic particles in some that you can even see without the aid of a microscope that are getting into the water that's in the bottle. And of course, there are concerns about ultimately what is that doing to our health?
Well, there's definitely microplastics in drinking water from the tap, but there's more microplastics in single-use plastic bottled water. And in fact, Dr. Sherry Mason at Penn State has done some really important research documenting higher levels of microplastic in bottled water than tap water. So if listeners are wasting their money buying bottled water, of course, you need it in emergency situations or if your water is contaminated. But if you're just casually buying bottled water every day because you need a beverage, you are unnecessarily likely consuming some microplastics, particularly when you turn the cap, the plastic cap, may be releasing very minute amounts of microplastics into your drinking water.
And Phoebe, as long as we're on the subject of water, what about those filter pitchers, you know, like the Brita pitchers and so forth, that people tend to think are a better alternative than single-use water bottles? Are there any concerns about those plastic pitchers?
There are concerns, and they come from multiple sides of that plastic pitcher. So one, the filter itself may contain plastic particles, but more importantly, the filters that we have today, they can eliminate some of those plastic particles. They're small enough to capture the larger, I guess, of these plastic particle size. But unfortunately, the smaller ones, as Judith alluded to, the microplastics, and in my work, even more importantly, the nano-sized plastics, which are significantly smaller, thousands of times smaller than the microplastics, they can't be captured by these filters that are commercially available. And even more importantly, they can't be captured by the filters that are in our commercial water availability. So either commercial bottled water as you're purchasing or the tap water. They're just too small to be able to make it through those filters.
Yeah. We'll talk about solutions and what we can do as an alternative a little bit later in the show. But Phoebe, I want to ask you about two particular chemicals in plastics that have been getting a lot of attention, and I'll need your help on the pronunciation here. Is it bisphenols, BPA?
Yes, bisphenols.
Okay, and then phthalates?
Phthalates.
Phthalates,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what are they, and in layman's terms, and where might we find them?
So these are chemicals that are added to different kinds of plastics. They have a global term as well called plasticizers. And so they're added to kind of change the form of the plastic itself. So we think of polystyrene, for example, as a well-known plastic product. And polystyrene can come in different forms. It can come in foam, like styrofoam. We have those cooler containers that we especially use in the summer. But then it can also be a hard, rigid plastic as well. And based on the different plasticizing chemicals that are added to that can change the form and therefore the usage of these plastics. Now, unfortunately, many of these plasticizing chemicals, as you're alluding to, specifically the bisphenols or BPAs and the phthalates as well, have been identified as endocrine disrupting compounds, which means that they can change how our body reacts to our own hormones, or they can act as a hormone unto themselves.
Okay. And so the way I was thinking about this was that one of them is more present in harder plastics, right? And the other was that the phthalates that is more present in the softer, more pliable.
Yes.
Kinds
yes,
of
that's
plastics.
A good way to think of it. Yes. Especially when we think of the bottles that the BPA has been taken out of at this point. They're all that hard, rigid plastic. And then the phthalates are more malleable. They make the plastic softer.
So sometimes you will see on a product that it's labeled BPA free. So does that mean we're in the clear?
That means that we're in the clear for the BPA chemical itself. Unfortunately, as Judith alluded to, the chemical companies are really good at their job. And so they might have just changed one little chemical compound in that BPA to make it something else, like BPS, for example, or BPF. So these also have endocrine disrupting outcomes, endocrine disrupting compounds, but they're no longer considered BPA. And therefore, they can be added back in. And so some of the work that I've read before has almost identified it as a chemical whack-a-mole, for example, that you might be free of BPA, but you might insert a different letter there at the end and still have the same health outcomes or health concerns that we did with the BPA.
So as I have been preparing for this conversation, Phoebe, one point that kept coming up was more research needs to be done, that it's not definitive that these certain chemicals cause certain specific types of illness. So what do you say to that, to the fact that the research is incomplete at this point?
I think that's true. And after watching kind of the COVID-19 unfold in front of us, scientists are cautious. So we need to have hard evidence in front of us to be able to say definitively yes or no. So a lot of our work has those qualifiers. It may lead to, it could, it's likely. And people read that as a, there's still an out. But in scientific world, we need to have it proven not only in our own individual laboratory, but it needs to be reproduced as well. We need to see it in multiple sources to really show this cause and effect notion. And so because this idea of microplastics is so new, we're really still doing a lot of research to understand what they're doing in the human system or the mammalian system.
So we are talking about plastics, the things that we need to know, and how we might be able to reduce our dependence on plastic. We'll welcome your comments and questions when Radio Times comes right back. Don't go anywhere.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about plastics, the proliferation of plastic, because it is, in fact, everywhere. It's in our clothes, and it's in our cars, and it's in the dust on our dressers, and it's in our cosmetics. It's really, well, you can't really get away from from it, and we're producing hundreds of millions of tons of it every year. The concern among many researchers is that some of the chemicals in those plastics can be hazardous potentially to our health. And of course, as we've said, more research needs to be done, but enough research has been done that there is cause for concern and a need to investigate further. So that's what we're talking about on Radio Times. We welcome you to join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and of course, you can always give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our guests are Dr. Phoebe Stapleton. She is an assistant professor of pharmacology and toxicology at Rutgers University. And Judith Enck is with us. She is a senior fellow and visiting faculty member in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action and the president of Beyond Plastics. So where we left off was we were talking about the fact that more research does in fact need to be done, but enough has been done that researchers are concerned about some of the health effects. And Phoebe Stapleton, I want to begin with you here because you mentioned microplastics and even nanoplastics. I want to talk about how prevalent they are and the concern that now scientists are saying they've been found in human blood. What does that tell us? What does that mean?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting study that came out in March, followed by another one that identified plastic particles in live human lung tissue as well. So it's the first time that it had been identified in living tissues. The one in blood and lung both are really interesting. They're a little bit different. The one in blood identified the polymer compound, so the chemical, and the one in the lung identified the particle itself, which was a little bit different approach between the two. But either way, both of them are identifying that we are indeed seeing these particles in humans and in human tissues.
So what does that mean then? And what's the concern? I mean, you feel like, well, it probably can't be good. But what are researchers worried about specifically?
No, so they're worried about two things. One, the identification in human lung identifies that we really are exposed to them. We're breathing them in. That's the way that they're getting into human lungs. And then when you follow that with the blood paper, in addition to a paper that came out recently to identify these plastic particles in human placenta as well, we can see not only that are we being exposed, they get into that initial exposure, the lung, the GI system, we eat them, but then they're also able to escape that initial barrier. We think of the lung as a barrier from the inside and the outside, and the same with the intestines. We think of that as a barrier. And lastly, we think of that with the placenta too, as a barrier between the maternal and the fetal compartments. And we're identifying that they can indeed breach these barriers and get into our systems, which means our cells are interacting with them on a minute-to-minute basis. And these are cells that aren't supposed to be interacting with things from the outside world.
Yeah. And you also mentioned, of course, the endocrine disrupting piece of it, right?
Yes. So now we have identified that these plastic particles are actually there. We combine that with this idea that there are these plasticizing chemicals, whether it be BPA or phthalates, that are embedded in these plastic particles. And now we have kind of a perfect storm where our cells are able to directly interact with these particles that may be releasing these endocrine disrupting compounds. But that's all speculation right now. We haven't identified that clearly in the scientific literature yet.
Yeah. We've got a number of emails from our listeners. Judith, I'll direct this one to you. Matt says, I feel like most people don't realize that plastic comes from oil. Can you talk about the relationship between the oil industry and the way we perceive plastics? My mind used to separate the fossil fuel crisis and the plastic crisis when really it seems like one enormous crisis, he says. So, Judith, what do you say?
Historically, plastic was made from oil and chemicals. Today, it's mostly made from chemicals and ethane, a byproduct of hydrofracking. So the future of plastics is very much connected to the future of fracking. And in fact, I have said that plastics is the plan B for the fossil fuel industry because they are losing markets for fossil fuels for transportation because of electric cars and electrification of the whole transportation sector, hopefully. And they're losing business because of the shift to renewable energy and energy efficiency away from fossil generated energy. So the plastics industry has teamed up with the fossil fuel industry, the chemical industry, and are building these multi-billion dollar polluting facilities called ethane crackers. In fact, there's one in the final stages of construction in Pennsylvania that would result in using ethane, the byproduct of hydrofracking, to make more of the ingredients of single-use plastic. So we historically have been focused on plastic in the ocean, the very serious concerns about health impacts, how plastics has been a recycling failure. But my organization, Beyond Plastics, is really working hard on the connection between plastic production and climate change. And in fact, if you go to our website, you'll see a report we issued late last year referring to plastics as the new coal. Our analysis found that within the decade, there will be more greenhouse gas emissions from plastic production than from coal-fired power plants.
Mm. Well, we have another email here, and this one is from PJ, who says, and Phoebe, I'll direct this to you, since BPA is used in polycarbonates and phthalates are used in PET, is anything used in polyethylene? What products use polyethylene, and is it relatively safer?
That's a really interesting question, and unfortunately, I'm not sure that we have enough data to answer that question. I really feel like the answer is probably likely back to that idea of the chemical whack-a-mole, in that the BPAs and the phthalates have had the most research done with them. I think they've been in the products for the longest amount of time, and so looking for what chemicals are used in the other polymers, like the PEETs, would be a great thing to explore. So unfortunately, I can't confidently answer that now.
And Phoebe, a question from Andrew. This goes back to hormones, who says, have you seen any research that is showing effects of plastics on hormone expression in humans? So are there specific things that researchers are seeing?
So there are specific things that researchers are looking at, specifically the estrogen receptor and estrogen production. So those kind of feminizing hormones, more than anything, activating those estrogen receptors. Unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with the temperature. So Judith indicated that some of that might be released in an environmental context. Things are getting hotter out being in the sun, but the body temperature is regulated, and in comparison, it's at a relatively low temperature. So we're not sure if the body temperature is enough to get these chemicals to consistently release.
Yeah. So all of this begs the question that if there is research that has shown some very concerning things, where is the FDA in all of this? And Judith, I'll begin with you, but what does the FDA say about the research that we're seeing so far, and why at this point is it still okay to, you know, eat our food from single-use containers or to drink our water out of plastic water bottles?
Well, the FDA is missing in action on this important issue. About 10,000 unique chemicals are used in plastics, and more than 2,400 of them are not adequately regulated. There are chemicals that are not approved for use in food packaging in some jurisdictions, and we don't have an environmental cop on the beat looking at all of this. This is very much self-regulation. People should not assume that the FDA or the EPA, where I used to work, is on top of this. They're just not. So it's really up to the individual brands, you know, McDonald's, Starbucks, Pepsi, Coke, to ensure that there are not problems with the plastics in their packaging. I personally am not really confident that self-regulation works. But this needs a really deep dive, and this would be a terrific topic for a congressional investigation. I just I just have very little confidence that the FDA or any federal agency is on top of this issue.
Well, let me follow up with this, Judith. I was reading this on the FDA website where it says, you know, we've performed extensive research, we have reviewed hundreds of studies and conclude, and I'm quoting now, that current approved uses of BPA in food containers and packaging are safe, unquote, and we're continuing to monitor the scientific literature. So how do you respond to that?
I don't have a lot of confidence in that statement. I don't know if they're doing independent testing. I don't know if they're doing spot checking. They could be a much more muscular regulator. It reminds me a little bit of where our society was on smoking issues, you know, a few decades ago. The tobacco industry said, don't worry about smoking, don't worry about secondhand smoke. The government was doing very little on this. Actually, it was the EPA that did some of the groundbreaking research on health impacts of secondhand smoke. And, I mean, how many decades were people told not to worry about tobacco? And it feels to me like we're in a similar spot on plastic. However, these plastics have been used literally, you know, thousands of different types of plastics and additives and plasticizers have been used for decades. And the studies are limited. The studies are mostly being done by independent researchers like Dr. Stapleton. A lot of the important health research is being done in Europe. Where is the federal government on this? I think they are missing in action.
I have to agree with Judith. I think that it's a very reactionary way to moderate things at this point, similar to the analogy of smoking, in that these products have been around for over 75 years at this point. And so we're really most of a generation in at this point. So following some of those health outcomes associated with increases in different disease states, I think would be really important to kind of associate the two at some point, especially looking at all the metabolic diseases that have increased recently during that same 75-year time period. So it seems very reactionary at this point.
Yeah. And Tracy, I just want to add one reason why it's so inadequate is because of intense lobbying by the plastics industry targeting these agencies. The moment any concerns are raised, you've got a pretty ferocious lobbying force in Washington standing in the way of taking action, including, you know, comprehensive research. Every move is challenged by the chemical industry and the plastics industry.
Hmm. So, Phoebe, this also sort of begs the question, in terms of kind of putting things into perspective for us, if we are ingesting some of these microplastics and even nanoplastics, and I'm thinking about BPA and phthalates in particular, because those seem to be the two that get the most attention, how long does that stay in our system? Does it come out of our system at some point? How does that work?
So that's a really great question. What we've identified in some of the work that we've done in our laboratory is that they do get in, they do get past those barriers. Unfortunately, those are really snapshots currently. So in some of our work, we have found them in our maternal fetal experiments, and we've found them in the fetal tissues in particular. And of course, we work in an animal model to identify those outcomes. But it's really a snapshot that we found them at that point in time. And so that begs the question if these particles could be identified over longer amounts of time. And those studies are underway. At the same time, the microscopy groups, the ability to identify these particles is still of a concern in that it takes a lot of really fancy special microscopy like Raman spectrometry, dark field microscopy. We're using lasers and different types of lights and things like that in order to identify these particles, because not only do we have to identify that they're there, but then we also have to identify what type of particle they are in addition. And so the scientists are really catching up with the physicists and the chemists and the biologists all working together to be able to find and utilize the tools to be able to find these micro-sized particles, or even more importantly, these nano-sized particles, because there are so much of greater prevalence. And then we can ask the question of what, once we find them there, what exactly it is that they're doing in these tissues that they don't belong in.
Yeah. So for someone listening to this and thinking, okay, there's reason to be concerned. On the one hand, you know, the FDA says no reason for concern at this point. You know, I drink water out of a plastic bottle or I heat up my food in a plastic container. How do we sort of strike the proper balance between alarm and appropriate concern? How should we be thinking about this, Phoebe?
I think that's a great question. And that's, of course, what comes up to everybody's mind. And it's really what your personal comfort is, because even as I sit here and I look around the room, there are containers that are made of plastic. The table probably has a resin on it. The computers we're using, everything is because of the convenience. The single-use masks that we've been using for the last couple of years, all are made of plastic. So it's really what you are in the socioeconomic status to be able to do about that, because some of those options are a little bit more expensive than others, and you might, just might not be in the ability to take advantage of those. And secondly, it's a matter of convenience. So if you know the trade in your mind is to be able to heat something up in the microwave quickly to feed your family, well, then that's the route that works best for you.
Yeah. And along those lines, Judith, in our, I've got about a minute and a half, I guess, before we take a break here, but I'm just thinking about, you know, as is so often the case, when we see these kinds of problems, they tend to hit poor communities, communities of color, disproportionately. Can you talk about that as it relates to the plastic issue?
Sure. And that's why when I left EPA, I decided to work full-time on plastics issues. It's because of the environmental justice concerns. Plastics are manufactured in low-income communities of color, places in Louisiana, Texas. There's a stretch along the Mississippi River called Cancer Alley because there's such a concentration of petrochemical facilities. So people's health are being damaged during the manufacturing of plastic. And then if plastics are sent to garbage incinerators or landfills on the other end of the spectrum, it's almost always low-income communities and communities of color that are hosting polluting garbage incinerators and landfills, like in Camden, New Jersey. So there's a lot to be said whereby if these manufacturing and disposal facilities were located in more affluent communities, I think we would see a substantial change. And also, there's a lot we can do about this.
Well, and I think I'm so glad you said that, because that is what I want to take up when Radio Times comes back. We've been talking about the problem of plastics, the fact that plastic is just everywhere. It's in our clothes. It's in everything, pretty much. And there are some health concerns that researchers are unearthing as they look into all of this. But there are also things, simple things, that all of us can do to reduce our reliance on plastic and to enhance our own health and that of the planet. And that's what we'll talk about when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. We're talking about plastic. It is everywhere. It's in our clothes. It's in our cars. It's in our furniture. It's in our food containers. It's in our water bottles. It is now, scientists say, in our bloodstreams. And so researchers are very concerned about that, looking into the potential health risks of some of the chemicals that are in plastics. So we've been talking about that. But we also want to talk about some solutions and what are some ways that we can reduce our dependence on plastics for our own sake, as well as for the health of the planet. Some simple things, maybe things that we can do today. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Call us at 888-477-9499. Our guests are Judith Enck, who is president of Beyond Plastics, visiting professor at Bennington College and a former EPA administrator. Also with us is Dr. Phoebe Stapleton, who is an assistant professor of pharmacology and toxicology at Rutgers. She studies the effect of nanoplastics on maternal fetal health. So when we left off, we were just beginning to talk about what we can do to reduce our reliance on plastics and to, you know, enhance our own health and that of the planet as well. And Judith, I'll begin with you. Simple things, that steps that maybe people could take today to begin to reduce reliance on plastics.
Well, there's a lot we can do. For instance, when you go to the supermarket, bring your own reusable bag. I personally think that we need systemic change. For instance, next week in New Jersey, the plastic bag ban will take effect on Wednesday, May 4th. So in New Jersey, when you're at the supermarket starting next Wednesday, you have to bring your own bags. They will no longer provide plastic bags or paper bags. And it's an easy thing to do. You just have to remember to bring your bags with you. When you're at a restaurant, say you don't want the plastic straw with your beverage. If you're like me and you're a heavy coffee drinker, make a point of bringing your own cup to the coffee shop. I think what folks want to do is look at their own purchasing habits. Look at your own kitchen. What's in there that's plastic? So, for instance, in our home, we use a lot of orange juice. So rather than buying big plastic jugs of orange juice, we buy the frozen concentrate. And I bought a glass pitcher, which we've been using for years. If you're a family that orders a lot of takeout food, be sure to tell the restaurant you don't need the utensils or the mountain of napkins and condiments and straws. You just want the food. And there are some local governments that have adopted local laws where you don't automatically get all the utensils and everything else unless you ask for it. You know, if you want to go to the next level, buying in bulk, you know, food co-ops often allow you to bring your own glass jar, for instance, to fill with various products. What we need to be careful about is businesses are passing the blame onto us as consumers. And we often don't have much choice. I definitely encourage people to look at, for your own health, for instance, how do you reduce particularly your use of plastic for food packaging? But ultimately, we need new laws on the books that don't just promote recycling of plastics, because we can't recycle our way out of the problem. But we need new laws that actually require reductions in the use of plastic. That is by far going to help the most people and make this more affordable.
Yeah. A couple of things there, because you've given us quite a bit to unpack, and I'm just picturing people arriving at the supermarket next week with no bags and finding that they can't get bags. So I imagine that that's going to be quite an adjustment, Judith, at least in the short term, as people sort of get acclimated to the idea of having to bring their own bags.
Yeah, there should be a lot more public education. Now, when you get to the supermarket, you can buy reusable bags. So, you know, people in New Jersey, get ready. Next Wednesday, you have to bring your own reusable bags with you, and you will find that it just becomes second nature. Mm. I live in upstate New York, where we've had a plastic bag ban in effect for over a year now. And it makes my heart sing standing in the parking lot and seeing virtually everyone bring reusable bags in with them. Yeah. It's so easy. You just have to get in the habit.
So speaking of reusing things, there's a question here from Cletus who says, is it okay to reuse plastic water bottles? I don't want to contribute to single-use waste, but I read that one type of plastic isn't good to reuse. Phoebe, what do you say about that? I mean, on the one hand, you're sort of, you know, being conservative and being efficient and all of that, but it is, in fact, plastic. So
it is, yeah. So I think that's really a great awareness that you're not trying to to add to the problem by getting a new one each time. And I have to admit, I have a plastic water bottle that sits on my dresser that I reuse regularly. I keep it out of the sunlight. That would be the primary concern, to keep it out of your car where it's going to heat and cool and heat and cool. That's where we're getting a lot of these chemicals being released from, again, that change in temperature. So I think if you would like to reuse it, then that's great. I think investing in the single-use bottle that's available lots of different places might be a great option. So one-time purchase, and then you can have that refillable option for you. But I think it is okay, but you do want to make sure to keep it out of the heat.
So, and you also mentioned about heating, you mentioned heating up plastic, and you and I were talking just before the show about, you know, food containers and microwaving our food in plastic containers, or putting the saran wrap over the top of the container to throw it in the microwave. What are your thoughts around that? Do we need to stop doing that and get glass? How should we think about it?
Yeah, so I did just as Judith initiated, I guess, or spoke of a moment ago, that I kind of took a look at my own world as I started to get into this research. And just as she identified, I took a look at the kitchen and realized how many of those reusable plastic containers we had. And I have two relatively small children, so it's very easy for us to throw something in the microwave, heat it up, because they get angry when they're hungry. And so it's I'd like to feed them quickly. And so I realized I shouldn't be heating up their food in this plastic, and then coming here and talking about the, you know, negative effects when I'm doing it at home. It felt very hypocritical. So I did just as Judith suggested. I went out, I bought plastic, or not plastic, I bought glass Pyrex containers. That happens to be the brand name. There are, of course, other glass products that could be out there to use in the refrigerator for our leftovers and things. And just a side anecdote, my daughter came in as I was unpacking, and she's about 8 years old now, seven at the time, but came in as I was unpacking these and knows what I do for work. And so she came in just, what are you doing? And then explained, we're going to get rid of the plastic container, cabinet that we have and switch over to glass. And, oh, good. I'm so glad you have this plastic thing figured out. And then turned and walked out of the room. And I thought, I barely see the iceberg coming, let alone being at the tip of it. And so, but I'm glad in her world I have this all figured out.
She says you've got it nailed.
Right. But just as an example of little things that we can do. Again, it's going to be a one-time investment at the beginning, and I can appreciate the cost. And I'm very fortunate to be able to have done that and move those out of our kitchen. But at the same time, little things like that, to have those reusable containers as opposed to either single use or the reusable but with this chemical concern associated with them.
And I think cost is such an important point, Phoebe, because, you know, I was reading that some people buy these like beeswax coated cloths to replace, say, saran wrap and put wrap their food in it and stick it in the fridge. That can get expensive. It may be a good thing to do from a health standpoint, but it can also be very expensive and prohibitive in a lot of ways.
It can be very prohibitive, especially for certain individuals at certain financial points in their life. And so I think of some of the lower end retailers as well. They seem to be more processed foods in those lower end retailers than there are at the higher end. I know, some retailers have ground meat, for example. They're in a styrofoam container with that absorbent pad underneath, all of which are made out of a plastic with the saran wrap over the top of it. And then I look at higher end retailers, and it might have the same type of meat, but it's vacuum sealed. Yeah. And you don't have all of those extras put in of the additional processing. And then in my mind, the additional risk of getting some of those plastic particles mixed in with the food items.
Yeah. I want to read a couple of comments from our listeners. Sepriel, and I hope I'm saying the name right, says, I pick up street trash all the time in Philadelphia. I don't think we can count on people doing the right thing. We need to go after the companies that produce them, which is a point that Judith made earlier. Jane says, I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I'm very concerned about the link to these chemicals and the rise in breast cancer. We also have a question here from Deborah, who says, I see a lot of clothing saying it's made from recycled plastics. Is this a good idea health-wise and planet-wise? What happens to those garments at the end of their lives? I notice that they start out soft and then change texture over time. What's happening there? Phoebe, how do you answer that?
So I think, Deborah, that's a great point that we haven't identified yet. We talked a lot about food, but we really haven't talked about the domestic products as well. And so one of the areas that these plastic particles are getting into our homes is actually through the dryer lint as well. And so you consider, we're washing our polyesters, we're washing some of our mixed or mixed clothing. And really that dryer lint has a lot of those particles in it and can easily become aerosolized. There's a lot of plastic going on in some of those single-use clothing or low-end discount retailers that you know, purchase, you wear it once or twice, then you move on. And again, some of those very soft blankets or the couches now that are made out of the soft materials. So that is another area of concern. So again, it becomes a financial capability, but if you're able to buy items that are definitely, you know, cotton, wool, some of those not plastic, polyester, nylon type of materials, then that would reduce bringing those into your home as well.
Yeah. Judith, a couple of questions about recycling. For those of us who take those plastic bags back to the supermarket, and there's usually a bin right inside the door that you can put all that plastic in, what happens to those bags?
Good question. In a lot of stores, the plastics are just tossed into the trash.
Really?
In other stores, well, because if you actually look in the containers, it's often not marked well, and so other trash gets in there, or the store has not made a plan to get the plastic film collected. Single-use plastic bags is plastic film, which only has a 5.5% recycling rate. So it depends on the store and how careful they are. I bring things like plastic bread bags and frozen food bags and put it in those bins and just cross my fingers. I don't want to discourage people from doing that, but poke your head into the bin and see if it's all plastic. And also, do what I do, which is torture the nice store manager and ask them if it actually gets recycled. I don't always get a clear answer.
Well, and for those who are conscientious about recycling, you know, we see those numbers on recyclable containers, you know, and most people don't know off the top of their heads what those numbers mean, or there's always the question of, is this recyclable or is it not? Can you give us some quick rules of thumb about what are the numbers we need to know and what's generally recyclable and what should we either put in the trash or try not to use? Judith.
Sure. So those are plastic resin identification codes. They were never really intended to guide consumers, but, you know, it's the Wild West when it comes to plastic recycling. So we need to follow whatever we can. So in general, only plastic that has number one inside the arrow, which is polyethylene tetraphthalate, or number two, which is high density polyethylene. If you see number one or number two, you can put that into your recycling bin. So that's beverage bottles, juice containers, shampoo bottles, milk bottles, things like that. Everything else, do not put in your recycling bin because it likely is not recycled in the end. There's a big difference between collecting recyclables and actually getting it recycled. There are not markets mostly for anything other than number one and number two. A few communities will take number five, polypropylene. So check with your local recycling coordinator. But rule of thumb, only put number one and number two in. The rest of the stuff contaminates the load. But more importantly, try to avoid plastics. We have alternatives that are easy, like glass, metal, cardboard, paper. And if you look at recycling rates, according to the EPA, and I think this is a generous number, plastics is recycled at the rate of 8.5%, paper and cardboard at 66%. But the difficulty for all of us is when you enter any American supermarket, you have very little choice. And that's why we need to adopt strong laws like extended producer responsibility. We need bottle bills, 5-cent deposit on containers, because beverage containers that have deposits on them are recycled at a substantially higher level. We can't solve this just with our individual consumer choices. We need new laws on the books. We need federal agencies doing their jobs. We need systemic change to protect not only our health, but the environment, our rivers, our ocean, our friends and neighbors who live downwind of plastic manufacturing plants in Louisiana and Texas have been suffering for decades. Yeah. If we have new laws to reduce plastic, it's the best way to deal with the entire spectrum of these problems that we've been talking about.
And certainly there are some of those laws in various parts of the country, but they are not yet consistent, and we are running out of time. So let me begin by thanking our guests. Judith Enck is president of Beyond Plastics, visiting professor at Bennington College and former EPA administrator. Phoebe Stapleton is an assistant
regional director,
and of pharmacology and toxicology at Rutgers University. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.